Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Welcome to the Roche Analyst Call from ESMO Live Webcast. I'm Iruna, the Chorus Call operator. The conference must not be recorded for publication or broadcast. At this time, it's my pleasure to hand over to Mr. Karl Mahler, Head of Investor Relations. Please go ahead, sir.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to our conference call at ESMO IO. Thanks for your interest in Roche and that you could join us so late in the evening. The team just came back from the late-breaking presentation of IMpower150, presented by Professor Reck in Geneva. We have with us Alan Sandler, the Global Medical Development Team Leader for Tecentriq in lung cancer, Sush Patel, the Lifecycle Leader for Tecentriq in lung cancer, and online is as well Dhan Sheng, the Medical Director of our CIT franchise. My name is Karl Mahler, the Head of Investor Relations, and let me start with a few introductory remarks from my side. First is IMpower150 is the first phase 3 trial using CIT chemo combo plus minus Avastin to show statistically significant and clinically meaningful progression-free survival benefit in first-line non-small cell lung cancer. And the current preliminary data in overall survival benefit with additional 5 months are meaningful. So far, the longest offering in patients in that setting on the backbone in the past, we talked maybe about 2 months additional. So 5 months is really meaningful on these preliminary data. And this was also endorsed today in Geneva by the discussant and as well as by the presenter. They were talking about impressive progression-free survival. I quote, impressive progression-free survival. They were also talking about a potential new standard of care, just to give you a bit of a feel and more details later on where this is most appropriately and in which setting. So importantly, Tecentriq and Avastin and chemo combo showed a clear clinically meaningful improvement in outcomes regardless of biomarker status, including TF lows, PD-L1 negative tumors, regardless of EGFR, ALK mutations, or liver metastasization. And Tecentriq and Avastin chemo combo was well tolerated and consistent with known safety risks. We will also get back to this one later on. As you will see from the presentation, we could very nicely replicate our original registrational trial E4599 in the control arm, which in fact set a very high hurdle for non-small cell lung cancer first line. And I'm happy to say that we did better and that we improved on it. And today we also had a lot of calls, and we also had some notes comparing a smaller trial from a competitor with the data we presented at ESMO. And allow me now some remarks maybe on this one as well. I mean, the keynote 21 and the most important difference is here, of course, the sample size. You have in Keynote 21 a very small trial with only 2 times 60 patients with an inherent risk of patient selection introducing a bias in the outcome parameter. So this is basically the first one. Second is, while cross-trial comparison in general are a bit a bad habit, I would like to say comparing now a phase 1/2 with a large phase 3 trial is even less inappropriate. And let me go a little bit more into the details. In general, trials with a small sample size run the risk that already a handful of patients have a major impact on the result, and this became apparent in the 21G trial. They had unexplained overperformance in the arms, and as such, for example, the control arm was 8.9 months. You would historically expect about 5 to 6 months. And just to contrast that, in our Roche IMpower150 trial, we yielded similar results of about 6.8 months and 6.2 months if you compare the historical control with that what we had for IMpower150. And the response rates for Keynote 21 was highly heterogeneous across the various PD-L1 stratification, and there was unknown histology which was imbalanced across the arms, and this was actually also mentioned by the CHMP the other day when they refused the filing for Keynote 21 in Europe. But last but not least, let me get a bit mathematical here. Not just the number of all randomized patients with the 2x60, but also the number of censored patients prior to the observed medium is important. And this is relatively high for Pembro in the 21G, with about 16 censored patients, and then the number of patients that are still at risk for the Pembro arm at the observed medium is about 15. In contrast to Empower 150, with about 356 and 336 patients in the Atezo versus control arm, there are only a handful, and I counted it's less than five, of sensor patients prior to the medium, and the number of patients at risk are still 180, respectively 150 patients. So as you know, the sensor patients prior to medium can still impact the medium positively or negatively, and as such, the trial readout at this point in time for Tecentriq is very solid, but this is not the case for KEYNOTE-21. So I know that we are all tempted to make the uncomparable comparable, but I really have to say in this case, it really makes no sense. Expect tomorrow same comparisons? I'm not sure. I hope not, I have to say. I hope not. So changing gear, also paused in Power 150, there are still some open questions, as you can see from my slide, for the industry in general, in respect to changing competitive landscape, in particular the translatability of data from small studies to outcomes in large trials. I have just touched on this one. And second, what we additionally still do not yet know is how the efficacy of CIT agents do in view of different histologies, so instance, non-squamous, squamous, small cell, and with respect to chemo backbones. And while we have seen that Tecentriq seems to do at least as good as bevacizumab plus chemo, at least in terms of PFS, we have to wait for more mature overall survival data to draw final conclusions on some of the questions which we have started. But overall, we are very pleased with the overall profile which we have gotten so far. And with this one, I would like to hand over to Alan, who actually was the lead investigator for E4599 some years ago, Alan, where you established this backbone for the industry. And you will run us through the presentation of Professor Reck in Geneva. Alan, over to you.
Okay, well, thanks, Carl. And so I think we'll move on from the title slide to the next slide, the disclosure and the background. So I won't spend a whole lot of time on this, but as you all know, the standards of care for patients with advanced frontline non-small cell lung cancer include targeted therapies for those with EGFR mutations or ALK rearrangements, pembrolizumab with PD-L1 expressing tumors with a TPS greater than 50%, and of course, platinum-based chemotherapy with or without bevacizumab in this setting. Atezolizumab has demonstrated overall survival benefit in the second-line setting and is approved for use in both the U.S. and EU for the treatment of patients with second-line plus non-small cell lung cancer, regardless of PD-L1 expression. And then lastly, a phase 1b study of atezolizumab with various platinum doublet chemotherapies in patients with chemotherapy-naive non-small cell lung cancer demonstrated promising efficacy and a tolerable safety profile. Now, in addition, there is a rationale for combining atezolizumab with bevacizumab, and that extends beyond the fact of its anti-angiogenic capabilities. So it's also known that bevacizumab's inhibition of VEGF has immune modulatory effects that are depicted nicely, I think, in this particular slide. So there's promotion of T-cell priming and activation via the dendritic cell maturation. As well, there's normalization of the tumor vasculature, which allows for increased T-cell tumor infiltration. Lastly, establishing an immune-permissive tumor microenvironment by decreasing MDSC and Treg populations. So therefore, the atezolizumab T-cell-mediated cancer cell killing may well be enhanced through bevacizumab reversal of VEGF-mediated immunosuppression. So here's the study design for Empower 150. As you can see, it's a three-arm trial with a 1-to-1-to-1 proportion, and this was for stage 4 or recurrent metastatic non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer, chemotherapy naive, who were bevacizumab eligible. And these patients must have had tumor tissue available for biomarker testing for PD-L1 IHC status. Stratification factors are listed here. And the other important note that I want to mention is that patients with EGFR mutations or ALK aberrations were, in fact, eligible for study entry, but must have received at least one prior TKI. So patients were then randomized to the one of three arms. We'll list them alphabetically. Arm A was one experimental arm, which was paclitaxel, carboplatin, and atezolizumab. Arm B was atezolizumab, carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab, so essentially adding atezolizumab to E4599. And then lastly, arm C is the control arm of paclitaxel, carboplatin, and bevacizumab. So beyond the 4 or 6 cycles of chemotherapy that in combination that patients were allowed to receive, and this was determined by the investigator at the time of study entry, patients did go on to maintenance therapy of either bevacizumab alone, tezolizumab alone, or the combination. And again, the major question for this study is twofold: to assess whether or not the addition of atezolizumab to arm C provides clinical benefit, or where substitution of atezolizumab for bevacizumab also may provide benefit. So the next slide shows the study populations and objectives. So again, it begins with the ITT population, which includes all randomized patients. We then it is then split into the ITT-WT, which is the ITT wild-type population, representing 87% of patients, because 13% of patients had harbored either an EGFR mutation or an ALK aberration. This ITT wild-type population was then evaluated using a novel biomarker of T effector gene signature expression divided into T effector high or T effector low, and we'll spend a little more time on that in a moment. Primary objective, there were co-primary objectives, investigator-assessed PFS in the ITT wild-type, or this investigator-assessed PFS in the T effector high wild-type, and also overall survival in the ITT wild-type population, and the key secondary objectives are listed on the right.
Alan, sorry that I interrupt you. For those who want to follow the presentation, this is all on our investor relations website, and you can just download the presentation which was given today at ESMO. So kindly go to the website which you opened and download the presentation. Sorry that I interrupt you, Alan.
Oh, that's quite all right, Carl. So now on the slide looking at biomarkers in Empower 150. So Empower 150 provided us with the opportunity to evaluate multiple strategies to enrich for PFS, which included the novel T effector or TF gene signature expression, as well as the PD-L1 IHC staining mechanism. The T effector gene signature is defined by messenger RNA expression of 3 genes, PD-L1, CXCL9, and interferon gamma. It's a surrogate for both PD-L1 expression and pre-existing immunity. In the OAK study, the T effector gene signature appeared to be a more sensitive biomarker of PFS benefit for monotherapy atezolizumab as compared to docetaxel, more so than that with PD-L1 IHC expression. Lastly, PD-L1 expression was evaluated using the SP142 IHC assay, as previously defined in the OAK study. So the next slide, which I believe is number 11 if you've downloaded the set, is the statistical testing plan for the co-primary endpoints in Empower 150. And I'd like to spend a little bit of time on this because it can be a bit complicated. The basis for this particular study design, which is a hierarchical testing looking at arm B and evaluating the efficacy in arm B first before looking at arm A versus C, is based on the following logic. Adding a novel entity to an existent chemotherapy regimen should, in theory, provide a better chance of success than a substitution of one agent for another. Therefore, arm B, which is the 4-drug regimen, was evaluated first in a statistical fashion shown here. We compare arm B versus RC, and we look at PFS in the ITT wild-type group, along with PFS in the T effector high wild-type group. After that's been evaluated, the next step will be to evaluate an overall survival. Overall survival is evaluated with the minimal alpha spend at the time of the initial PFS, which is mature, and which I'm going to be presenting to you shortly. There will be another look at overall survival the first half of next year, again comparing arm B versus C. If that overall survival is positive for arm B, we will then go on to compare arm A versus arm C in the same fashion. We will show you some preliminary data from arm A versus C later. So here are the baseline characteristics for the ITT population. So this is the entire population of 1,202 patients. I think the take-home message here, number one, is that it's extremely well-balanced and typical of clinical trials in this patient population. I'd also like to point out that approximately 10 to 11% of patients carry the EGFR mutation, 2 to 4% the ALK rearrangement, and when you look at the T effector gene signature, about 42% or so of those patients are tested T effector gene signature high. And then lastly, looking at PD-L1 expression, using this SP142, approximately 48% or so are T low or no expression, and then those and roughly half are carry some form of PD-L1 positivity. So this is the important slide in the primary endpoint. This is the investigator-assessed PFS in the ITT wild-type population for arm B versus C. And so remember, this is that population without EGFR or ALK aberration. What you see here is a statistically significant improvement for arm B over arm C with a hazard ratio of 0.617 and a p-value of less than 0.0001. The median goes from 6.8 months in the control arm to 8.3 months in the experimental arm. The minimum follow-up is 9.5 months, and median follow-up is approximately 15 months for all three arms. One thing that I'd like to show before we go to the next slide is you'll note a relatively early separation of the curve, but that the curves continue to separate more and more with time, strongly suggesting that the median, which is a single point in time on this curve, is not the most appropriate evaluation of this curve. And we'll go to the next slide, where we have the landmark analyses. And so if you look at the six-month mark, you see that the number of patients alive disease-free at 6 months is 56% on the control arm and 67% on arm B. And that increases in terms of difference, going from 18% to 37%, which is more than a doubling of the number of patients alive that are disease-free at 1 year. And I would offer that this is unprecedented in this particular patient population that has been tested over time. Next, we'll look at the investigator-assessed PFS in the T-effector high wild type. And so here you also see a very impressive hazard ratio of 0.505. with a statistically significant p-value. And here, as you have earlier separation of the curves, you have improvement in the median from 6.8 to 11.3 months, also with improvement at one-year mark going from 18 to 46%. So now let's spend a little bit of time on the various subgroups, initially with clinical characteristics and then as it relates to levels of PD-L1 expression. So I think the first thing that you notice from this particular curve is that all of the diamonds are to the left of the line of unity, showing that all subgroups benefit with the addition of atezolizumab to Taxol, carboplatin, and bevacizumab. I think some important points to look at, I think, are liver metastasis, which, regardless of the type of treatment that's used in this setting, has notoriously been a difficult population with which to treat. But those patients with liver metastases actually had a hazard ratio of 0.42, and those without 0.63. Another interesting aspect is the successful treatment of those patients with KRAS mutants. Next slide looks at PFS in the key biomarker population. And so, again, to refresh your memory, the ITT wild type is at 0.62, and that's the point of reference. If you look at EGFR and ALK mutant-positive patients only, so that roughly 13% of the population here, you see a hazard ratio of 0.59. And as you all are quite aware, there's been some question of the benefit of immunotherapy in this patient population. This would suggest otherwise, and in fact, again, represents the first look in a randomized phase 3 setting in the frontline patients showing a benefit of treatment of immunotherapy, and specifically atezolizumab in this group of patients. When you then look at the ITT population that now includes the EGFR and ALK patients, you have a hazard ratio of 0.61. Now, the other aspect to look at here is, are those patients that have high levels of expression of either PD-L1 or the T effector high? And you do see a gradation of benefit, suggesting that those patients that have higher levels of expression derive more benefit. But very importantly, however, you see that the patients with little or no expression, either by PD-L1 or T effector low, also derive a statistically significant benefit in terms of PFS, 0.76 for the T effector low and 0.77 using the PD-L1 IHC mechanism. And the last one that I'd like to show is at the bottom, and this I think is of interest because of some previous data that's been out, but this looks at IHC staining for TC3 or IC3. A question that is reasonable to ask is, are our results driven just by the highest levels of expression? And I would argue that this clearly shows that that is not the case. Although patients with TC3 or IC3 levels of expression have a hazard ratio of 0.39, which is an extremely impressive hazard ratio in this particular setting, those patients with TC 0 to 2, representing roughly 80% of the population, have a hazard ratio of 0.68. Again, all of these subgroups statistically significant. So now let's look at overall response rate, and this is shown here for the ITT wild type on the left, as well as the T effector high on the right. And you see that for RMC, which is the control arm, a 48% response rate, but a 64% response rate, including 4% of patients who actually achieved a complete response with the four-drug regimen. For T effector high, you see similar, although slightly higher, response rates for both groups. And now this slide shows a preliminary look at overall survival in the ITT wild-type population comparing arm B versus arm C. And I think there are several points with which to look at this particular curve. So number one, the hazard ratio is 0.775 with a p-value of 0.026. But this is a very early look with, I believe, less than 45% of events having occurred at this particular point. The minimum follow-up, which I've mentioned before, is only 9.5 months. But you do see an improvement of nearly 5 months in the median survival from 14.4 months to 19.2 months. This did not yet reach statistical significance. The next look at this survival data will occur the first half of next year. So, although I've mentioned before that a formal statistical analysis of arm A versus arm C has not yet been conducted and will not be conducted until and only if the overall survival for arm B versus arm C reaches statistical significance. However, let's look at some of the data. So, response rates are similar in both arms at around 49 and 48%, and the PFS hazard ratio is 0.936, and this PFS data is mature. Overall survival hazard ratio, however, is 0.88, and is survival that's still, again, being very early, and with the non-proportional hazards that's been seen, has an opportunity to improve with time, and as I've mentioned, will be looked at the first half of next year. So the next couple of slides look at our safety analysis, which again listed here. We have, again, RMC, which is the control, which the results were very typical of that seen in ECOG 4599. I think some of the take-home messages here is that the combination of adding atezolizumab to the ECOG 4599 regimen did not increase in a significant fashion any of the toxicities, whether they be immune-related or otherwise. If you look at serious AEs, treatment-related serious AEs, they are roughly around 19 to 25%, a little bit higher in arm B, not uncommon when you're adding a fourth drug to an already three-drug regimen. And lastly, the AEs of special interest, which are those AEs as defined as possibly immune-mediated. Only two patients with a grade 5 AE of special interest, and only around 10% of patients in the atezolizumab-containing arms that had even grade 3 or 4, so a very well-tolerated regimen. This takes a deeper dive in the immune-related AEs of special interest, seen in at least 5 patients across the various arms. It's a bit of a busy slide. Take-home message again, though, most of those toxicities relate to grade 1 and grade 2, very few grade 3-plus side effects seen. These side effects also were generally relatively rapidly reversible. And so in summary, IMpower 150 is the first phase 3 immunotherapy-based combination study that demonstrates a statistically significant, clinically meaningful improvement in PFS in the all-comer setting of a frontline non-squamous metastatic non-small cell lung cancer cohort, providing a potential new standard of care for patients. PFS benefit was demonstrated with the addition of atezolizumab to the combination of bevacizumab and Taxol and carboplatin when compared to Taxol, carboplatin, and bevacizumab alone in all populations tested, including patients with sensitizing EGFR or ALK genetic aberrations, T effector low tumors, PD-L1 negative tumors, and those patients with liver metastases. Atezolizumab in combination with chemotherapy with or without bevacizumab appears to be well tolerated, and its safety profile is consistent with known safety risks. The OS data, while not mature, is promising in the arm B versus arm C comparison, and the next interim analysis for all arms is anticipated in the first half of 2018. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Sush, could you kindly take over and walk us through the overall program for Tecentriq?
Yes, I'm happy to. So hopefully you've all switched over to the next slide deck, and so if you want to get to the next slide. So as we think about shaping the treatment landscape in the future and walking you through the strategy, we really talk about this in three waves. The first wave is really launching rapidly, and we've already done this in lung and bladder cancer and actually approved in over 50 countries, and we currently have over 20 filings ongoing. As we're talking about today, we're rapidly moving into wave two, which is really where we see we can be establish a strong competitive position through our combinations in the near term with chemotherapy, and Alan just walked you through the first of those, which is the IMpower 150. I think it's important to note that this actually has really helped us close the gap, and in some cases, in some markets such as Europe, potentially it allows us to be first to market, which I think is really important as we move quickly into wave two. And then finally, as we sort of develop a deeper understanding of immune biology and a deep understanding of the best combinations, we want to get to that that transformative therapy option for patients in the future. Next slide, please. So just to go back a little bit, I want to talk a little bit about OAK, and OAK was our phase 3 study in the second line setting, and I think why this is important is, firstly, it had very consistent efficacy and data to what we've just been presented from the IMpower 150. Firstly, we saw a clear all-comer and strong all-comer benefit here with a hazard ratio of 0.73, which translated into a median OS difference of around 4 months. Some of the things that we see in the OAK study, which are very similar to the data we see from the Empower 150, is the efficacy in the PD-L1 subgroups. So once again, we see enrichment here with the very high subgroups, the TC3, IC3, but importantly, we also see benefit in the low and no expression patients, which again is very consistent with what Alan just shared with you, and I think important as we think about the future frontline landscape. Next slide. Now, this is our overall program in lung cancer, and it's very extensive. We just went through the 150 data, and I think some of the important things to note is really as we think about how we translate 150 to some of our other chemo combinations, it's important to note that arm A, you're really substituting the atezo for the bevacizumab in arm C, and in the other studies in Power 130, 131, and 132, we're going to be adding atezo to the chemo combination of the standard of care, which really is more like what we're doing in arm B. So again, we have combinations that address a number of questions, including steroids. So Empower 130 and 131 are Abraxane studies. And I think importantly, as we think about non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer, we also have a pemetrexed combination, which we'll be reading out in the very near future. So we really believe this provides a suite of combinations that cover the whole frontline landscape. We also have monotherapy studies. You see the Empower 110 study. Not listed here, we also have a really interesting study with blood mutational burden, which is a hot and exciting topic, and that's called the BFAST study, which is already enrolling as well. And then finally, we have an adjuvant study in Power 010. And then one other area that we won't talk about much, but again, also leverages concurrent chemo combinations, is looking at our study in Power 133 in small cell lung cancer. So as we think about the frontline market, one of the important aspects of our program is we have combinations that really cover all the key segments in terms of squamous and non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer. As I mentioned, we also have a study in small cell lung cancer. And as you see today, about 10 to 15% of the market is treated with an EGFR or ALK mutation. And obviously for ALK, we have our best-in-disease molecule, alectinib. But one thing that I think is unique to our program, and Alan mentioned this, is our studies, at least several of them, included those patients. And again, these are patients who have had previously treated ALK and EGFR inhibitors. Those were enrolled in the 150 and the 130 study, and I think this is an important segment because what happens with EGFR and ALK is those patients do become refractory to treatment and have very few treatment options, and chemotherapy is certainly one of those ones that becomes available, and this is certainly a significant patient population, particularly in some markets like Asia. Now, when we think about the other aspect of this slide on the right-hand side, today, the vast majority of patients, whether they're non-squamous or squamous, are treated with chemotherapy, which very much fits with our strategy of adding on to chemotherapy. Even in the U.S., where we've seen the introduction of immunotherapies, about half of that 50% or so share you see there is in combination with chemotherapy. So again, we believe we're well positioned to build on the current standard of care. One other aspect that I want to highlight is Avastin is considered a standard of care globally. And is widely used, and you can see the rates here across the U.S., the EU, for LATAM, et cetera. One important aspect as well is it's very widely used in Japan, and in China, Avastin recently became available on the national formulary, and we see a rapid adoption, and we expect that number to increase substantially over the coming years. So this is an important slide in that it just, again, highlights, this is the E45-9 study and the Empower 150, and I just wanted to highlight a couple of points. One is the consistency of the control arm that we see in 150 versus the data we saw with E45-99. If you look at the one-year PFS, you see 18 months on E45-99, and the control arm in 150 was also 18 months. However, as Alan mentioned, there was more of a doubling of that 1 year when you added Tecentriq to the combination of bevacizumab and chemotherapy. And then the only other thing I'd want to highlight is also the increase in the response rate you see, around 15% increase versus the control arm. Again, Alan showed you this slide, and I think there's a couple of important aspects. Previously, ALK and EGFR inhibitors, the data in terms of the efficacy of PD-1, PD-L1s based on second line was not very clear, and in fact suggested maybe there may not be a benefit. However, in our Birch study, our frontline study, we saw that there could be a benefit, and this was nicely replicated in the 150 study. When you look at the hazard ratio for the EGFR and ALK, or previously treated EGFR and ALK patients at 0.59, which was very similar to the ITT. We also see benefit in both the PD-L1 high. We see that enrichment and the T effector high. But similarly, we also see benefit in the low patients. I would just direct you to the bottom of the slide, the TC3, IC3. In some ways, this is the closest analogy we have to the pembrolizumab cut point. And you can see a very robust 0.39 hazard ratio there. So certainly, I think this is an option for some of those patients. But again, I think, you know, when you're comparing combination treatment to monotherapy, we still expect most of the patients to get monotherapy, but with a hazard ratio of 0.39 and a strong response rate, certainly some of those patients would be candidates. And again, we think the vast majority of patients who aren't high expression would be appropriate candidates for the EMPOWER 150 regimen. So moving maybe on, this is slide, I think it's slide 16, excuse me. So, again, I just wanted to highlight that the arm A versus arm C is very preliminary data, and I think we need to be careful of jumping to conclusions that we will not see a benefit here. I think we need to wait for the overall survival, which we should be getting towards the sort of middle of next year. Next slide, please. So as we think about the overall landscape in non-small cell lung cancer, we've seen today that EMPOWER 150 is the first positive phase three showing a clear all-comer PFS benefit. And I think you have to put that into the context of recent studies such as MYSTIC, which actually missed on PFS even in a diagnostic positive population, although we await their overall survival. As we move into 2018, in addition to the final OS from 150, we're expecting a suite of studies to read out with a range of chemo combinations. And again, we believe this is going to position us very competitively in terms of timing versus the competition, given that we've heard of potential delays in some of those versus what was previously reported. So again, we believe we'll have a very strong position and first-to-market opportunity with a number of those readouts coming next year. And as I mentioned, small cell lung cancer, we're also in that same space where we have our study reporting out very competitive timelines to the competition. So as we go beyond lung cancer, where I mentioned our comprehensive program, we have a number of other indications. We have our frontline renal emotion 151 study reading out in the not-too-distant future. We also have studies with triple-negative breast cancer with IMPASSION 130 and third-line colon cancer with IMBLAZE 370. I think what's going to be important is the insights we're going to gain from these in terms of what's the impact of different combinations, the impact of targeted therapy in combination with immunotherapy, biomarkers, and again, getting more insights into the importance of certain endpoints over OS versus PFS. So, again, beyond wave two, which I think we're all very excited about, I think ultimately the goal is how do we potentially remove chemotherapy and bring transformative benefits to patients, combining with some of these novel CIT targets. And we have, I think, a very broad and diverse CIT portfolio. You see just some of them here. We have some particularly interesting targets looking at T-cell directed and T-cell bispecific molecules, and also an interesting FAP IL-2V molecule. These studies are actually going to be reporting out data in 2018. We look forward to sharing some of that data with you in the not-too-distant future. So finally, I just wanted to conclude with some of the highlights that Alan said. We do believe this represents a new standard of care for the treatment of frontline non-small cell lung cancer patients, which was consistent with both the presenter and discussant today. We see a PFS benefit that's consistent both from the independent review as well as the investigator assessed. And as I mentioned, there's some really interesting insights we've seen in terms of some of the subgroups, particularly the EGFR and ALK mutations, as well as the fact that we have benefit in the low and no PD-L1 expressing patients. As Alan mentioned, the combination was very well tolerated and consistent, and the safety profile is consistent with known effects. And once again, OS has a numerical improvement, an encouraging numerical improvement, but data are far from mature, and we look forward to sharing the more mature data with you in the first half of 2018. So I will stop there, and I think we want to take questions.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I have a question actually to Alan and maybe to Dan, because, I mean, What we had today is any kind of, let's say, lifting on comparison between small trials and large trials. You compared basically 5-6 patients in an extension of one trial versus 150, 200, 300 patients on the other trial. I mean, if you as an oncologist sit on the other side, what is your impression if you, let's say, compare those small data versus the large data? I mean, how do you take it, let's say, from a more practical point of view, from a physician point of view?
Yeah, thanks, Carl. So I think this is something that all of us are certainly familiar with, and the fact is that a randomized phase 2 study is in general signal-seeking and one that is difficult to make definitive statements regarding it because of the potential imbalances with either known or unknown prognostic factors and offers a lot of challenges. Also, as many of you all know, as who have followed the oncology world for any period of time, also know that there is a graveyard of failed random, of positive randomized phase 2 studies that resulted in negative phase 3 studies. And so I think that it's important that these smaller studies be confirmed with a larger randomized study. And in fact, 21G will be confirmed or is attempted to be confirmed in 189. So that same approach is being utilized, and it's true with all of the other checkpoint inhibitors. I think that for us right now, what we have done is completed a phase 3 study in the frontline setting and have shown convincingly benefit with respect to efficacy by, with the addition of atezolizumab to the ECOG 4599 regimen with respect to progression-free survival, and now also with encouraging results seen in overall survival that hopefully will continue to improve over time, and we'll see that the first half of next year. So I think that, those would be my comments, and I think Dan would like to comment as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think Alan is right on here. Lung cancer is a disease that is notorious in terms of having difficulty in reproducing smaller trials in larger trials. And that's likely because there is, we know that in earlier phase trials, there tends to be a much higher amount of patient selection. So if you cherry pick lung cancer patients, these patients tend not to reflect the broader population of lung cancer. And it really reflects the importance of completing large randomized phase 3 studies so that you have confidence in the ultimate conclusions that you make. And it's one of the main reasons why we went after not just one phase 3 here, but a suite of phase 3 studies, because we really want to, with great confidence, define what the right regimen should be in this space for immunotherapy. What's the right chemo partner? Do you want to combine with Avastin? And we've started on that process with the readout of Empower 150.
Okay, thanks a lot. Can we have the first question from the line, please?
The first question is from Matthew Weston, Credit Suisse. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much. Three questions, if I can. The first is really around filing strategy and whether we should expect to see you file the data based on PFS. I realize that's fully possible. It was a primary endpoint. Or given that the OS read is expected to be so close, whether we should wait for you, whether we should expect you to wait for that before you file. The second issue is one that you raise about being first in the ex-US market. Clearly that is very important, but it's also a market which is much more cost-focused. And so how should we think about how you are going to address the cost hurdle of the double-branded combination plus chemo versus other options that are out there? And then finally, the ESMO discussion was, I guess, I would say, less focused on the idea of winner takes all. Clearly, you have positive data across the board, but she was very much suggesting that this is a regimen that should be considered in PD-L1 positive, but less than 50%. Or that you should use tumor mutational burden or other markers to look at the data. Clearly, you now have the Foundation Medicine panel approved. So can you just walk us through retrospectively what you expect to do with the data to look at other forms of how you can slice and dice it and when we should expect to see that data?
Sure. So maybe I'll take the first question on the filing strategy. So we believe, and we've heard from regulators, that a strong PFS benefit is sufficient in itself to file. However, as you noted, we will be sharing the totality of the data with the regulators, and that will include the OS data as well. In terms of the cost issue that you mentioned, certainly we'll also be launching in the US as well. But if you talk about cost constraints in the EU, certainly we'll need to see what the totality of the data looks like, and clearly we're going to cost and price this relative to the value we bring to patients and the clinical benefit. However, given the fact that we have both the drugs in this regimen, I think it does provide us flexibility, and we have a number of flexible pricing and access solutions which we will be able to leverage at the local level to ensure broad patient access. And in terms of the biomarker question, maybe I'll hand over to either Dan or Alan.
So I'll at least start with that one. I just want to clarify what I believe Dr. Peters had mentioned, actually, that although those patients with less than 1%, she mentioned that all the data looked reasonable, she wanted to wait until the overall survival was confirmed and looked at that, particularly in that low or no diagnostic group. So I think that if, in fact, we do have survival data, that may be sufficient, but I don't want to speak for her completely. To your other point, though, regarding other biomarkers, yes, it's certainly true that we are looking at various biomarkers, much as we presented two biomarkers on this particular study with PD-L1 expression and T effector as well, and we are looking at others, including TMB, but I'm going to let Dan Chen address this more completely.
Yeah, I mean, I think just briefly to put into context, as you think about the biomarker low subgroup, I think we've discussed the 0-0s had a progression-free survival hazard ratio of 0.76. And just to put that into context, this is just in the patients with the lowest amount of evidence for pre-existing immunity. These have been the patients that have been the hardest to show benefit in. And we were able to do that with Tecentriq as a single agent in second-line lung cancer in OAK. Here, you're seeing in that same population a positive PFS benefit. We haven't even seen other regimens in frontline non-small cell lung cancer hit progression-free survival in any of the larger patient population, let alone in the most difficult segment. So I think right there what you see is that progression-free survival signal for a patient population that has historically across many trials shown the least benefit from immunotherapy, we are actually hitting the highest bar for immunotherapy in progression-free survival. And so that should give us confidence that as we follow out the larger data set for longer periods of time, that this is meaningful benefit in terms of progression-free survival and likely long-term survival. And that's what we've seen from this field. When you see progression-free survival benefit, progression-free survival may not be a sensitive marker for benefit, but it's been highly specific. And so when you see it, that tends to portend for an excellent long-term outcome. And so I think that we feel confident that across the board here, we are seeing a consistent signal for benefit, regardless of whether you're PD-L1 high, PD-L1 intermediate, or PD-L1 low.
Thank you. Next question, please.
The next question is from Lisa Hector, Exane. Please go ahead, madam.
Hello, thank you for taking my questions. Could you comment on the post-progression treatment that you're seeing, any data you have on second-line use of IO and which agents, and whether there was even any crossover into Tecentriq? And then on the side effect profile, there were some quite high numbers for dose interruption and modification, around 60%. I just wonder if you can explain what was happening there and how significant that was. And also the dropout rate, 33%, I think, with the Tecentriq Avastin arm. And then finally, I just wondered how you see this fitting into the European treatment paradigm, given that the use of Avastin, certainly with the carboplatin and Taxol, is perhaps a bit more limited? I think the discussant mentioned about 12% of first-line patients would get that treatment regimen. Thank you.
Yeah, so I'll see if I can't answer all three of those questions. So for post-progression therapy, roughly around 60 to 65% of patients on the control arm went on to receive some form of a subsequent line of therapy. 31% of patients did, in fact, receive some form of immunologic therapy, predominantly checkpoint inhibitor, other than atezolizumab. For the side effect profile, you were asking, so the predominant, so again, when you have a four-drug regimen or you have a multi-drug regimen, sometimes it's hard to tease out what drug is implicated in that. But in the best of our ability, looking at the data, there are no major patterns other than the fact that the majority of those that either discontinued or dropped out were actually due to chemotherapy-related toxicities. So with the respect to the European market and the use, I'll take a stab at it, this and see if Sushil would like to comment as well. But in essence, I think you do raise an appropriate issue in terms of the usage of Avastin. But I think what I'm thinking of this in terms of as a clinical oncologist is physicians would like to utilize what they feel to be the best regimen available. And so I think and then we'll adjust their patterns accordingly. It may not necessarily be easy, but if in fact this particular regimen proves to be the only regimen that shows these types of results, I think the choice will be relatively easy. If, however, this turns out to be one of many choices, including perhaps our very own regimens from 130, 132, say, for example, our own pemetrexed or carboplatin and atezolizumab regimen, then physicians will have choices with which they can use. And I think that that's the goal for us, to bring effective therapy such that patients and physicians have multiple options with which they can choose from. I'll see if either Dan or Sushil wanted to comment any further.
I think you covered that well. My only other comment is I do agree that probably the first physicians to adopt will be existing Avastin users. However, if we see a robust overall survival, I can certainly see that expanding. And as Alan said, it all depends on what this data looks like in the context of all the other readouts. And certainly, I think we're the first to demonstrate a clear PFS benefit in a phase 3 study. And so, again, I think physicians will adopt their and change their treatment practices based on the robustness of this data.
Okay, thanks a lot. Luisa, did that cover all your questions?
It did, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next question, please.
The next question is from Tim Anderson from Bernstein. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. A couple of questions. The discussant seemed to suggest that the TEF gene signature may not be much more than a proxy for PD-L1 status. It was a qualitative comment. They didn't show any sort of Venn diagram showing how the patients may actually be unique between TEF and PD-L1. I'm hoping you can give us your thoughts here. Are you confident in saying that TEF testing adds something totally different to the picture than PD-L1 testing? Second question is, I'm kind of troubled by some of the median overall survival data presented. We have to work hard to line it all up between the three different arms, but it's all there. With the control arm, you get median overall survival of 14.4 months. With arm A, you get 17.9. With arm B, you get 19.2. The difference between arm A and arm B is 1.3 months. I think most physicians would view that as underwhelming, and that's what you get by adding Avastin into the mix. So modest efficacy, but higher tox and higher cost. So my takeaway on this would be that four drugs really aren't needed when I look at those median overall survival values. How am I wrong in this assessment?
All right. Well, thanks. So I'll start with the T effector versus the PD-L1, and I think we agree with that of the discussant with Dr. Peters in that we're not necessarily believing that T effector adds sufficiently to the testing over that of IHC. There is a difference in terms of some of the patients in that there's overlap of roughly perhaps 70 to 75% of the patients comparing the T effector versus the IHC, but both of those, the results that you saw during the presentation show that those results were quite similar. And again, it's important to note that in the negatives with both forms of testing, the negative patients had a statistically significant and what we believe to be clinically relevant improvement in progression-free survival. So the next question is also one that's certainly of interest. And I think the major point that I would take with it is I think there's a, you know, there's that desire to turn a Kaplan-Meier curve into a mere single point and to utilize the median as a means to express an entire curve. And although that's very tantalizing and something that we all are tempted to do because it's so easy to put a single number on it, I think it underestimates the differences of the curves between those three arms or any arms on a clinical trial. And so I think that it would be better served and subsequently when we have more mature data and are able to look at this and look at this and present this in sometime next year, we'll be able to better show the various curves and see if we can't digest this a little bit differently. I think for now the best approach also is utilizing hazard ratios, which again showed for overall survival a statistically significant improvement of 0.78 when comparing arm B to arm C, again, showing the advantage of atezolizumab. And if you look at least the numbers that were available other than that of the median, I think you also show a significant in benefit, if you will, with the addition of bevacizumab as well when looking at A versus B. And, of course, I do have to mention that the trial was not designed to compare arms A versus B, but, of course, we all tend to do things like that. So that's basically my interpretation is I think it's, although tempting, I think utilizing a median to evaluate these curves doesn't do it justice. And I'll see if anybody else wants to comment.
Yeah, I'll just note that there was clear benefit for arm B over arm A in terms of progression-free survival, response rate, CR rate, and those are themselves clinically meaningful to patients. In terms of long-term survival follow-up, I think we agree that it's important and that right now at this point in time that the OS curves are starting to trend in the right direction. And if you look at it through the lens of statistics, the hazard ratio for benefit for arm B has a p-value of 0.02. And if you look at the arm A overall survival hazard ratio, it doesn't approach what we generally consider as being clinically significant, statistically significant. And so that's, I think, how we should look at this, the data that we have at this point in time.
All right.
Tim, does that answer your questions?
Yes, thank you.
But the benefit under the curve and maybe not the point-in-time analysis, I think that's a conclusion here. Next question, please.
The next question comes from Seamus Fernandez from Leerink. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, thanks for the question. So actually, I have three questions. So the first question, can you just help us understand the benefits that we saw in the EGFR ALK mutation patient population? That struck me as a very unique result and something that perhaps other companies may have studied less. I just want to know, one, what you think of those data from the physician's perspective, and then separately, is there a registrational opportunity in this patient population in your view? The second question, do you have any sub-studies specifically to potentially identify unique benefits of Avastin Again, there's a lot of claims that, you know, this may be may have immunotherapeutic benefits, whether it be by hypoxia driving up potential mutation burden, things like that. I just didn't know if you have any sub-studies that you are working on to identify an IO-type mechanism, because as I look at these data, it's hard for me to distinguish or differentiate what we're seeing from perhaps just a maintenance combination of atezo plus Avastin being being beneficial. And then the last question, I'm still trying to understand the extensive comparisons to KEYNOTE-21G in the context of the fact that we do have monotherapy data that looks extremely similar to these results from the KEYNOTE-024 study. So I'm just trying to get a better understanding. I think you guys said this, and I just wanted to confirm it, that you do think that monotherapy in the 50% plus patient population is likely to remain the treatment standard of care, but that some patients, perhaps those who are rapid progressors, might get a chemotherapy combination. Thanks so much.
All right. Well, let's we'll start from the top, the EGFR and ALK abnormalities, and what do we think of the data? Well, not surprisingly, we're pretty pleased with the data, and we, you know, it's roughly a similar number of patients that's within the actually the 21G. We have over 100 patients in this, showing improvement for PFS in this population, and so. I will say that one hint that we had, and one of the reasons we included these patients in our frontline studies, was the fact that in our phase two study of Birch that Sushil had actually mentioned in his part, we actually did see some improvement in, well, we saw some response rates. It was single arm, so there was, we can't talk about improvements. But we saw response rates of around 25 to 30% in that population. We saw interesting survival in that setting as well. So that provided us with some hints that it might be worthwhile studying this particular population. In order to protect that, we did look at the wild-type group first. But as you saw, the data for PFS, when you look at the ITT population in total, you see that same benefit. So that probably would lead to the answer to your question regarding registration, that we will be presenting this data, along in our package and looking for inclusion of those patients in that. The second one, you asked about sub-studies, and I believe you're probably referring to more preclinical studies, but I will answer the fact that this addition of this or this unique combination that we have has also, provided additional confidence on a clinical setting as well. And, of course, we have studies that are utilizing the combination of bevacizumab and atezolizumab in both, say, renal cell, hepatocellular carcinoma, and there's other malignancies with which to look at that as well. So that is something that we're going to do. I'll mention two things. One, as a simple clinician, and then I'm going to have Dan Chen speak on the preclinical aspects since he's much smarter than I am. But from a clinical perspective, I've often said that I'd much rather have a regimen that works, that I didn't know how it worked, than a regimen that didn't work, but I knew what it did. So at least for now, it looks like we've got a regimen that works, and we're still trying to figure out exactly how and why that is, but there's certainly compelling evidence to suggest that it's based both on the anti-angiogenic component as well as immunomodulatory effects. But now I'll turn the mic over to Dan.
Well, I'll just briefly note that we have a lot of data coming for the Avastin plus T-centric combination that will come across a number of different diseases across many different trials. So Empower 150 just represents our first data point supporting the use of this type of combination. And in terms of, you know, where the Empower 150 Arm B regimen will be used, I think it is fair to say that for TPS greater than 50 patients in the frontline lung cancer setting, that's reasonable to consider single agent checkpoint inhibitor as well as the Empower 150 regimen. But for all of those other patients, those patients that don't have tumor tissue to do the diagnostic testing on, for the patients that are 00 or less than TPS, anywhere less than TPS 50 for patients with EGFR mutant or ALK mutant, that the EMPOWER 150 becomes an important standard of care.
And I'll just add a little bit as it relates to the third question of Keynote 21G and Keynote 24, and I think that we've talked pretty extensively about the challenges of comparing the results from 21G to that of EMPOWER 150. So I think I've mentioned that, Carl's mentioned it, and we've really talked about that quite a bit. I think to your point of what about Keynote 24 and the results that we're seeing. It is noteworthy, I think, that, you know, Dr. Peters did, in her review, she did show hazard ratios for the progression-free survival for this similar population. They're not the same, but those that with the TPS greater than 50% and RTC3IC3, where the hazard ratio was 0.6 in Keynote 24, and our hazard ratio was 0.39, showing a fairly significant difference in the PFS. Now, again, I am a physician. I understand the difference between there's a high bar when you have monotherapy of a well-tolerated agent. That's a high bar to meet when you're putting a combination of four drugs together. But again, just to echo what Dan said, I think it gives physicians an opportunity to have another asset with which to consider using. It may not necessarily be in many of those patients, but it is something that at least a physician and a patient can think about what they may wish to do in that particular setting.
Thank you. Seamus, did that address all your questions?
Yep, that's perfect. Thank you.
Okay, perfect. Next question, please. We have still two in the line, so then let's try to, let's say, work all questions which we have today. Next one, please.
The next question comes from Jack Scannell from UBS. Sir, please go ahead.
Hi, good evening. I've got a question about the interaction between the different tests and evidence that there may be different efficacy of regimens in the low PD-L1 expressers. So I may be wrong here, but my understanding is that your antibody may be less sensitive than some of the others, so that some cells that would be stained positively by other antibodies would not be stained by yours, in which case those patients would look negative on your test, but positive for PD-L1 or others. So how confident are you that this sort of efficacy in the low expressors isn't just a sort of test artifact, it's something real?
So I can briefly answer that question. So I think there's a lot of misinterpretation around the blueprint results, which have led to this belief that there's a different level of sensitivity to the SP142 test. In fact, if you look at through all of the data from blueprint, what it shows is that the negatives across all of the tests are about the same. And in fact, we did the exact comparison specifically with SP142 and 22C3 in the OAK study. It showed essentially the exact same efficacy between 00s using 22C3 and 00s using 142. So we think that there are minimal differences between these assays in assessing your negatives. And here we've actually added a third. T effector is another way, just in case you weren't sure about SP142 and 22C3, here's another way to show that when you don't have pre-existing immunity, Tecentriq has a very powerful efficacy effect, even in those patients.
Does that answer your question, Jack?
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Last question is from Vincent Meunier.
Actually, I have, two questions in one. I mean, should we be concerned by potentially similar or very close efficacy between arm A and arm C? And would you consider starting new trials combining Tecentriq plus Avastin to other chemo regimens? And if yes, which ones? And if no, should we then consider it's potentially a missed opportunity?
All right, so I think I've understood the question correctly, so let me give it a stab. I think what you're suggesting is that given the results of arm A as compared to arm C and that the results were similar, does that change our enthusiasm for combining atezo with chemotherapy? So let's just refresh a little bit what our study showed when you look at arm A versus arm C. So that is not a comparison of chemotherapy with and without atezolizumab. That's a comparison of a substitution of atezolizumab for bevacizumab. And so when you look at that particular data, that shows that you can substitute atezolizumab for bevacizumab in that setting and get similar results. Of course, arm B shows that with the addition of Avastin to that, you get even better results. But staying with that concept of A versus C, if you actually look at, and some of our statisticians have done this, if you actually look at the A versus C and then look at it, the control arm, without the benefit of bevacizumab for that regimen, much like the control arm in 4599, you actually would have had a positive study. So I think it actually increases our confidence level and enthusiasm for combining atezolizumab with chemotherapy. And, of course, as you know, we have three such studies that we'll be reading out over the course of next year, and which, again, we have confidence and enthusiasm for those.
Okay, does that address your question?
I think there was one other comment about other chemotherapies, but
yes.
Those three studies we're combining with Taxol carboplatin, Abraxane and carboplatin, as well as pemetrexed and carboplatin. We also have cisplatin and etoposide in our small cell study. So there are, I think we probably have as broad and diverse a group of combinations with our agent as any other.
Yes, but actually, I mean, these combinations are atezo combinations, but they do not include Avastin. And we see that here, potentially, adding Avastin drives better results.
Okay, sorry, I missed that aspect. We do have other studies that we're looking at with the addition of Avastin. The real quickly, of course, our squamous cell study would not have Avastin in that 131. Remember that we have to look at appropriate control arms. In some of our studies, when you're doing randomized registrational type studies, however, we are going to be looking at other combinations, chemotherapy combinations, with the addition of Avastin as well. I'm sorry, I misunderstood all of
that. No problem. Thank you very much.
Okay, so Vanessa, I think that we could address your question.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks a lot for your interest in Roche. Also that you found the time so late, let's say, to join with us here. And I wish you a good, nice evening, and thanks for your interest in Roche again. And I also wanted to thank our presenters still being in Geneva. Have a nice evening. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, the conference is now over. Thank you for choosing Chorus Call, and thank you for participating in the conference. You may now disconnect your lines. Goodbye.